Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Hi, Rob Greaves here, and it's a pleasure to be bringing you part two of the three-part story of baby boomer Christine Easdow. In part one, we learned that Christine decided to follow a career as a teacher. While studying, she visits Southeast Asia, and while having some rather close encounters with a rather unfriendly Pathet Lao, the trip certainly kicks in a desire to travel. So it is, we feature both stories about her teaching experiences, the first of which in Chris's own words was a shocker, as well as her trips overseas. We learn how she goes from being a teacher to a super cook on a bus tour through North Africa, and she shares some amazing stories of her adventures. On returning to Australia, she returns to teaching secondary school students, and while she's in fact a good teacher, we learn why she decides to take a sabbatical and head overseas. Her decision to leave is traced back to a strong spiritual experience she had whilst visiting Israel, during a time where she was feeling she had a spiritual vacuum. So it is she eventually heads to India, where she works in a Delhi crisis centre for travellers. However, she does return to Australia to fulfil her obligations to the education department before she's off again, and this time to Kathmandu. We pick up with Chris talking about why she changed universities during her early student days.
So I ended up changing unis, and I'd met someone who did their dip ed at Melbourne State College, and Melbourne State College had a less academic dip ed. They had five streams, you know, ranging from the very conservative, everything is done, everything was a very academic, like they had at Monash. Mm-hmm. I chose something which had a combination of traditional and non-core subjects, so I did a lot of electives, and that was fun. One of the electives I did was water ecology and canoeing, so I went up to Eildon and had a great time canoeing. Improved some of my canoeing and water skills. Don't remember too much about the water ecology, but I do know that, you know, I learned about carp, and I learned a few things about carp that I won't share. And I can't even remember the little fish, other fish that were native, but we let them. And then the second one was purely fun, and that was ski touring up at Mount Baw. But I then was able to persuade the college that I would really benefit from doing a third field trip, and that was where geography students had been invited to join up with the environmental science mm-hmm. stream at Melbourne State College and do a field trip, which examined the impact of recreation on an alpine environment. And it was just the best week. I think I learned so much in that week. I had great fun with the environmental science students. They were a really cohesive bunch of young people. But the great thing was it also set me up when I was teaching HSC geography many years later, and it gave me the basis for some field work for my students.
So you did go on and teach then?
I did, yep.
What was your first teaching experience like?
A shocker.
We can't let that go.
Well, actually, I mean, my teaching rounds were good. I ended up in three very different schools, mm-hmm. and I had lovely supervisors, and, you know, I felt as equipped as you can as a 21-year-old going out into a job after 9 weeks of practical experience. But I was posted to the Latrobe Valley, and I just felt like I'd landed in a world that I had no understanding of and didn't have, you know, sort of great skills to deal with. I was kind of lucky because I'd always played a lot of sport, and they needed a 0.5 phys ed teacher. So they asked me, because I played sport, would I like to do 0.5 phys ed? And I thought, oh, I'm sure that would be better than teaching in the classroom.
Well, you say it was a different world. Was that because of the nature of the Latrobe Valley in terms of it being mining, or was it that and the people, or the kids and the social implications?
It was a bit of everything, Rob. I don't think I really understood that the Latrobe Valley, so how industrial in some ways it was. So I kind of thought I was going to a country school. Well, I was. I went to a school in the regions, but, you know, culturally it was very different from growing up. I mean, I grew up in a 1950s cream brick veneer triple fronted house housing estate in the burbs, you know, where everyone went to church and, you know, everything was very proper and nice. And so I ended up in a very different community and I didn't understand. Like, it was really...
Sounds like it was culture shock in a way.
I think it was. I was about to say it felt very much like culture shock that I almost didn't recognise this as being a part of Victoria, Australia.
Right.
And I stayed at Moe for a couple of years.
Oh, that's a lengthy time.
Yeah. Well, I think I kind of thought after the first year, well, I need to really give this another year, but I knew by... you know, coming through the second year that I needed to leave. By that stage, I was living in Yallourn. I was living in the last house in my street. This was in 1978. Yallourn had been pretty much dismantled. All of the demountable houses had been bought and loaded on trucks and moved around the valley and to other townships in the foothills. I was living in a lovely double brick cottage, and it just baffled me that in the 1920s a plan was made to build a town that would be completely dismantled in 50 years. And so, like, we just, you know, I got stuck between two halves of a house going to work one day, which was a bit of a surreal experience. But like I said, like, our house was like the last house. It was kind of like, you know, it was like a mouth losing teeth.
There was just watching everything around you disintegrate.
Houses.
Yeah.
You know, the cinema went off to one town and the swimming pool went somewhere else, and all the services were divided up between the remaining towns in the valley. And so when I moved out, like, we were the last tenants in our house.
Gosh.
I saw the house about 4 months later when I was driving through the valley, and they were demolishing it. So, yeah, and, you know, I've driven back through your lawn and I can kind of look out into the space and say, oh, I lived somewhere around.
Somewhere in that gap.
Somewhere where that hole is.
Yes. So where did you go then?
Well, I ended up at, you know, just talk about chalk and cheese experiences, I ended up at Doncaster High.
Oh, my goodness.
So I didn't have a full allotment. I was a substitute reserve, so I sort of thought, great, I'll get to be sitting in the principal's chair for a while he's on long service leave. No, that's not how it works. Everyone got shuffled up.
Of course they did.
And so I taught linguistics and geography and history and social studies, I think, at Doncaster. Did some work in the library, did a lot of sports supervision. After that year, I was placed in excess and I decided to take the opportunity to go travelling. So I took a year off, which was because I'd had my studentship and 3 years teaching, I qualified for long service leave. No. It wasn't long service leave. That was actually a bit later. I was off. I could take a year off.
Right. You were so eligible to take time
off. I was eligible for a year off because it was one of the options if you were placed in excess.
Right.
So I went over to Europe for 12 months, and then when I came back, I went back to Doncaster High.
Listen to older voices, the magic of memories. I'm Rob Greaves, and I'm talking with Chris Easdown, and Chris is recollecting her experiences in her early years of her tertiary education.
Okay, before we go back to Doncaster High, whereabouts in Europe did you go?
Well,
were you based somewhere, or was it just constant travel?
Probably more constant travel. Europe was never a destination that had featured very highly, and I'd actually had hoped to do an overland trip from Kathmandu to London, but the friend who was thinking about going travelling decided to do something else. And I just wasn't in, like, this is like 1980.
Mm-hmm.
Kathmandu just felt a little bit wild and remote for me travelling on my own.
Yes.
So I actually flew to London And I joined up with a company that did camping tours through Europe and North Africa. So I ended up working as a super cook on the bus tours.
Oh.
So, which was really quite an interesting experience. Like, you know, it was my role to go into the markets and find the food and to coordinate the travellers in preparing food. And we had a fair few dramas on both trips. So in the first trip, the Moroccans wouldn't let us into Morocco because they thought we might sell the bus to the Algerians to support their war effort in the Southern Sahara. So instead of following plan A, which was to go into Morocco, travel across Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia and come back up through Italy, we did a lap of Morocco, then a lap of the Mediterranean, then a lap of Tunisia.
Oh, goodness.
And then back to London. So, but we saw some, like, it was just such an adventure. And going into these, you know, beautiful old marketplaces in Fez and Marrakesh were just, you know, no vehicles, no road vehicles can go in. You know, my first memory of the marketplace at Fez is to see this poor donkey that was loaded up to carry Coca-Cola into the marketplace, and it had this huge sort of wooden structure, and it was loaded up with Coca-Cola, and the, you know, little donkey just would plod through the narrow streets of the marketplace. And another clear memory is the beautiful citron drink that you could buy. It was quite hot, and it was like a lemon syrup with almond water or something. It was just delicious.
There must have been some beautiful scenery moments, though, because you're talking about some, even though there was a lot of war in that area, it's still a beautiful part of the country, yeah, the world, isn't it? I mean, well, the deserts.
We didn't see any of the war because we were well north of the South Sahara. So, you know, we went to the main centres down the coast. So we went to Rabat, which was actually the capital at that time, beautiful beaches. We drove through Casablanca. Don't remember much about Casablanca. But probably the highlight of that trip was the 3 days that we spent right out on the edge of the Sahara in the rocky desert. And the day that we were driving out there, you just kind of look out and there was just this, you know, flat desert land. Rocky, we're not talking sand dunes, we're just rocky desert. And there was this kind of line appeared close to the horizon, and the line got wider and wider, and it turned into this wonderful oasis, which had been developed into a tourist resort. So there was a little bar and hotel, and the spring had been channeled into two swimming pools. There was a camping ground, so we were camping tour, so we camped there. This was one of the few places where they had running water in the toilets. So the toilet block was three little squat toilets with a stream of water running underneath.
You tend to forget how important that is when you're travelling.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, which then went down and, you know, watered the gardens. Mm. So we sort of could wander around through the gardens, and there was the Casbah, like an old, you know, sort of castle-y thing right at the far end of the valley. There was a village at the top of the gardens where we were camped. One very funny thing happened was that one of my friends had a chillum in her pocket. Mm-hmm. This is late at night and we're in the toilets, and we just hear tink, 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 tink as the chillum dropped out of her pocket and washed down.
There it goes. Okay, right into that.
But that was just the most beautiful place. We drove through the Atlas Mountains and wonderful outlooks through
the evenings mountains. Must have been beautiful too, because very little pollution, I would assume. So you've got clear skies.
I don't remember those nights, but I do remember one night in Tunisia when we just stopped by the side of the road. I did two nights in Tunisia. We stopped by the side of the road and we just put our sleeping bags down on the desert floor and no tents.
Mm-hmm.
And we just looked up and the Saharan sky was just magic. It was just like this really, I mean, midnight blue, but it was like someone had thrown silver sprinkles over it. And that was what we went to sleep to. Just looking up at this extraordinary sky. I believe
they call that starstruck.
Absolutely.
Listen to Older Voices, Ageless Radio.
Yeah. So this wonderful adventure ends and you get back in Australia. Is it hard to come back and just take your life back on as it was?
Absolutely. I think I spent the first 6 months paying off a bit of money that I owed and then planning where I was going to go next. And some things had changed at the school. I actually had a full-time allotment then, and I was also in the staff room with other geography staff. So I kind of felt a bit more a part of the place.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there for 4 years, and in the last 2 years I was there, I taught HSC geography, which was a lot of work and a very challenging but very rewarding. I think I decided when I was going to uni that I actually didn't have a lot of track with really little kids, and I found that I worked better with students from year 8 up. And I taught year 8, 9, 10 and 12.
Right.
For most of the time I was there.
Okay, and then what happened? Did you leave by choice or did circumstances force you?
No, left by choice. So in 1983, I've left the church as a young adult, but mm-hmm. I've actually gone back to the church. I just felt like my life was a little bit off the rails, and while the trip to Europe had been a big adventure, there was also some real drama in there which left me quite traumatised, and I was really just trying to find a way of living with some of the stuff that had happened while I was away. And one of the things that had happened in that trip was that I was in Israel, and I went to a place called the Garden Tomb,
mm-hmm.
in just outside the Damascus Gate in Jerusalem. And even though we're in this sort of very busy eastern city, I just felt this extraordinary peace and mm-hmm. calm. And sometime later when I'm back at Doncaster High, I met someone. I was talking about this experience, and he talked about the peace of God, and it kind of made sense. And I think I also felt like I was in a bit of a spiritual vacuum. I really felt like I was quite without direction. So I ended up going back to church, hoping that I would find some sort of sense of inner stability and peace, and also a way to reconcile this trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, this bloke came and spoke to the adults group that I was a member of about a crisis centre for travellers in Delhi, where he'd been working. And he was just doing a bit of a recruitment, I guess, he was talking about it, he was fundraising a bit for the house. But it was just like this light went off inside me. It was just like, that sounds good. Pardon? Sounds great. Mm. And a friend of mine, one of my friends, went over to Delhi. She basically said, I'm going. And she was on a plane within a month. And during the summer holidays, I thought, well, I'm going to go over and investigate whether this is something I could do, because the sorts of crises that they worked with were people who were drug addicted or seriously ill, who needed a place to detox and get clean or find sanctuary.
Were these Indian nationals or
no,
were they?
No. These are all Westerners.
Visitors, yeah. Right, yeah.
So I went and spent 4 weeks in India at the end of 82 into 83, and spent 3 weeks in Delhi, New Delhi. And then while I was in Delhi, a couple arrived from the organisation's headquarters in Holland, and they were going to reopen the centre in Goa.
Mm-hmm.
And they invited me to come down to Goa for a week. So I did.
Right.
And Goa ended up probably being a bit more of a holiday because it was just about reopening the place and, you know, cleaning and re-establishing connections in the community. But Delhi was actually much more full on. We had in the centre there were people who were recovering from heroin addiction. There were some long-term travellers who'd been really sick who were just kind of convalescing. And even though this was a religious organisation, it wasn't that sort of heavy evangelism that missionaries often see as their mission. That wasn't the focus of this place. It was kind of like about what they called lifestyle evangelism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we still went to church and, you know, we did Bible studies and all of that in the centre. But we didn't necessarily go out and share our faith with everyone that we met. So I came back to Australia and thought, this is something that I would like to do, but I needed to prepare. There was lots of things that I needed to put in place before I felt that I could go. And part of it was I had my teaching allotment for that year, and it, you know, had a sense of professionalism that it wouldn't be right to leave.
Mm.
So at the end of 1984, I took long service leave from the education department. I had 6 months leave on half pay, and I packed up and went to live in Kathmandu.
Right. Yeah, that was a big move.
It was.
Yes.
It was very exciting. And, like, I kind of went with this expectation about all the great things that I was going to do and going to be helping all these people and, you know, feeling quite chuffed about that. I had no idea about what work was going to be done on me during that year and a half. Extraordinary stuff.
Okay, yeah. let's just investigate that a little. So you arrive in Kathmandu.
Yeah.
Where do you go?
Well, the first thing I did was I went on a trek, and I was going to meet up with some friends, but they had all the dates got muddled and I missed them. I went down to Pokhara and I missed them. They'd all headed off trekking the day that I arrived in Pokhara. So what would I do? Okay, I'll just go myself. I had maps. I thought, this can't be too hard.
Oh, goodness me.
And so I arrived in a village that first night and I met an Australian woman who was trekking with her parents, and they had a guide and a porter, but Mum and Dad were really struggling with the hills. So they decided that they would walk back to Pokhara and wait for their daughter, and mm-hmm. she would continue with her walk. And so I walked with her and her guide.
Ah.
And I befriended this lovely Tamang man who was the guide. We had a lot of fun. We got up to a village called Gorapani, and we walked through sort of over ankle-deep snow because there was a huge dump of snow the night before, and we built a snowman, and he had never built a snowman. So that was a lot of fun. But it was a wonderful break and something I really needed before I started work. And when I got back to Kathmandu, the bosses said, well, you've got to find your own role here. That was a bit of a shock.
Right, oh, so you assumed you were walking in and there'd be a program or something running
right.
that you would slip into. Yes.
Absolutely, but no, that wasn't the case. Well, there was sort of a program, but that was just the bones of things, like everyone had jobs around the house on Sundays we went to the Protestant congregation and once a month we would sing for them. And
yeah, but that's not going to fill your time.
That wasn't the whole week.
No.
But we heard about an arrest at the airport. This was about a week after I arrived back in Kathmandu, and arrested at the airport of a young Swiss woman who was caught with a couple of kilos of gold, and she was in Dili Bazaar prison. And I thought, oh, I could go and visit the prison. So, and there was my job. Twice a week for the next 8-9 months, I went down to the prison.
Was that a distressing thing to walk into? I wouldn't have imagined it was a particularly pleasant situation, or am I wrong?
Look, the prison was very basic, but the Nepalese are quite gentle people. I mean, they're tough. I mean, we know about the Gurkha regiments and how tough they can be, but culturally, they're very different. I'd been visited.
So it's nothing like Indian jails.
No, I'd visited a jail in India, and I found that a very troubling experience. Mm. The Nepalese experience was very different.
Right.
I mean, you know, they would sort of say that we were only supposed to have 5-minute visiting times, but often we would have longer. And so this woman didn't actually end up staying all that long. So a fine must have been paid and she was released. But over the course of the next 6 months, there were another 20 arrests of Westerners carrying gold.
Kilos of real gold.
Yes.
Okay. Well, the
prison system was somewhat, the justice system was somewhat baffling. So people would be sentenced when they went to court, which could take 2 or 3 months. They would receive a fine based on the street value of the merchandise or a prison sentence. So the prison sentence for smuggling gold was about 4 years, 3 to 4 years.
Next week, in the third and final part of the story, Chris talks extensively about her experiences and her work in both Kathmandu and India. Work that so exhausts her, she finds a need to return to Australia, where she returns to study and takes up a career in shiatsu and oriental medicine. There's so much to her story, so join Chris and I next week on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Uniting Victoria Tasmania. The program is funded from the Commonwealth and State Government's Home and Community Care Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.